Okay, it's a pleasure for us to be with you tonight to discuss a question that we've all thought about, I think everybody does. In a broad sense, it's the existence of extraterrestrial life. But in a more narrow sense, what we're going to be focusing on tonight specifically is the issue of UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Are they fact or fiction? Let me just share some data with you. Tens of thousands of sightings of UFOs every year, just in this country. Can 150 million Americans be wrong? About half of our population believes UFOs exist. And in fact, 30 million claim to have seen one. Carl Sagan once said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And that's our agenda for tonight, is to look to see if this extraordinary claim that there are extraterrestrials inhabiting UFOs that come close to Earth or on Earth, whether these claims can be in any way corroborated. Our panel, on my left and to your right, is at the far end down there, is Aaron Buskirk. Aaron was driving across Arkansas in his pickup a few months ago, and he was abducted by aliens, and he's going to share his story tonight. We didn't tell you that in the advertisement because we thought we'd be overrun with people dressed up like Romulans here. So, and then we have he's actually a pilot. And he's going to tell an extraordinary story of an encounter he had with a UFO just a few months ago. In fact, we have the air traffic control tape of exactly what happened that night. And we're going to play that so you can listen to it. It's like you're going to be in the cockpit of a UFO. Or of a jet, I mean. And then it is truly a privilege for us to have in the middle of our panel here Dr. Greg Ojikangas, who is a professor of physics at Drury University here in town. And Dr. Greg has his PhD in, I believe, planetary science from California Institute of Technology, Caltech. And he is, I believe, still actively on the list, the astronaut list of NASA. Is that true?
Ostensibly.
But he was one of the finalists in the astronaut selection program a number of years ago. So it is indeed an honor to have a true expert here to guide us in our discussion and deliberation. By the way, I should introduce myself. I'm a mere attorney, but a highly trained attorney. And, you know, I'm, among other things, I'm trained on how to think systematically, intentionally, consistently, and rationally. And those are excellent attributes, I think, when we're evaluating the kind of evidence we're going to be looking at tonight. Now, let's talk about this recent sighting. And what I thought I would do is just begin by playing the air traffic control tape. And when we're done, we're going to have Aaron explain in detail what exactly he saw.
I had to get this information through the Freedom of Information Act. And this guy is just explaining that's what this is. You're going to hear my wife on the radio. She was working the radios that night, checking in with the Denver Center, the control center, the air traffic control. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay. The Denver Air Traffic Control Center was working us that night on the radar coverage. That's who we were talking to. And then our tail number, which we go by for our call sign, is November 777 Alpha Golf. So when you hear that, that's us. And then there's another airplane in there. Their call sign is Brickyard. They're a commuter flight, and they are a commuter flight for Air Midwest and some others. They were heading to Milwaukee. Exactly, Republic. And also a little bit of United. They do kind of a lot. But there's Brickyard, there's November 777 Alpha Golf. Those are the two players. And then the Denver Air Traffic Control Center. So that's who you'll be hearing.
And Aaron, what kind of aircraft were you piloting?
We were in a Cessna Citation at 45,000 feet.
Let's go ahead and listen to the tape. That's what people came here for.
Okay.
Let's not disappoint them. Okay. This is in French, by the way.
But it's got Japanese subtitles.
And Harahachi Pu. We'll be speaking English tonight, though. But this This, my wife listened to this last night. I edited this down because they take the gaps and stuff out. And she said, I can't understand what anybody's saying. And nor will the audience tonight. So I spent time to just make an actual transcript of this that you can read on the screen here as you're listening to the very words themselves. Okay, let's go.
This portion of the recording concerns communications at the Sector 8 radar controller position during the period 0215 to 0230 on April 29th, 2010, Universal Coordinated Time.
777 Alpha Golf. Do you have anything above us northeastbound?
November 7 Alpha Golf. No, just you is all I'm showing. Hold on. November 7 Alpha Golf. Yeah, even on the primary is showing just you around the air.
Okay. I wonder if we're looking at the space station up there glowing.
Or 7 Alpha Golf, yeah, you know, it could be. I checked the primaries. I'm not showing anything that would be big enough to be anything out there right now.
Okay. Yeah, we see it, too. You think it's the space station? I don't know. I guess it could be. It's moving kind of weird, though. All right, it just changed direction, too. I think it's covering a lot of ground real fast. Yeah, it is.
For 7 Alpha Golf, what position is it from you?
It's at our 10 to 11 o'clock in high, and it passed from our 12 to 10 o'clock, and it looks like it's going away from us now, like a northeast heading. And we get 10:34. It's at our 12 o'clock. It was coming right at us, and it did like a 180 almost, or a big right turn, and it's actually almost out of view now. It's like gone.
In November 7 Alpha Golf, what color was the light you're seeing?
I would call it pretty bright white.
And Brickyard 1034, the light was white for you too?
Yeah, it was very bright, very high, fast. It was kind of slowed down for a bit, and then it looked like it sped up. And then made a slight right turn, and then was off the horizon.
Brickyard 1034, thanks. And November 7 Alpha Golf, contact Denver Center 132.17. We'll see you later.
3217, you have a good night. 7 Alpha Golf, we'll see you.
This is the end of the re-recording concerning the FOIA request involving November 777 Alpha Golf.
Okay, that's the recording. Aaron, let's have you comment on what we just heard.
Okay, well, what happened was we were coming back from Portland, Oregon, and there was reports in the area of some turbulent air. So the ceiling on this airplane is 45,000 feet, and we figure, well, let's go to 45, and if it gets bad, at least we can start coming down and find some smooth air. So that's what we did, and we were getting a pretty nice ride. The conditions that night were such that we had a layer of clouds below us, an overcast layer, and we had a full moon coming up almost right in front of us, and it was very pretty. And we actually had some guys from the back come up and look at it, because it was interesting seeing the moon come up from the clouds. And so we're cruising along eastbound. There's a nice moon in front of us, and I'll show you on the chalkboard over here. And this would be the horizon line out here, and this would be basically our panel. So we're looking at this going eastbound, and I don't know what I was doing looking down at something, and I look up, and the object is about right there. And it's just this bright white object. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange, because for 45,000 feet, there's only a few other airplanes that will go that high. And there's no airliners that go that high. They're about 41 is the top that they cruise. So that's why I inquired, do you guys have any traffic for us? Because this is unusual. And you heard him say no. It first started, it looked like it was moving a little bit to our left. And that's when I thought, well, maybe I'm seeing a reflection of the sun, because the sun had said it was about 9:20 in the evening, Central Daylight Time. And at 45, we're thinking, okay, maybe the sun behind us, maybe it's the space station. But then it started moving to the right. And that's when the Brickyard flight said, he's coming at us. And we were heading eastbound like so. The Brickyard would have been behind us at about our 4 o'clock position, I found out from the recordings. He was at 35,000, so he's got 10,000-foot different look at this thing. So, you know, you look at reflectivity and the lighting, but he's seeing the same thing we are. So then it starts moving over to our 10 to 9 o'clock, and it is really covering a lot of ground very fast. And I thought, well, if this is an airplane, he's got to be close to get that perspective of speed. But then I thought, well, if he's not seeing it on radar, it's not a star, because we've seen falling stars, we've seen comets. It's not a star. It's moving in a lateral direction and very fast. It moved over to about our 10 o'clock, and it either made a 180-degree U-turn or it stopped and it backed up, because it went from our 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock position coming back around to our 12 o'clock position, but never made it to the 12 o'clock, more like a 10:30 position. And I thought, well, if this is an airplane with landing lights on and it's coming at us, as soon as it made its U-turn, you would lose the landing lights. So I thought, it can't be an airplane. Then I thought, well, if it's military, why would it be lit up? If it's some kind of a secret military airplane, you would think it would be dark. So it makes a U-turn, or it stopped and backed up. With our perspective, it would be impossible to tell, but the light never changed. It was like following a spotlight. And then it stopped, and we're looking at it, and then it took off like a bullet to the northeast. And it took off faster than anything I've ever seen depart. If you've ever played golf and you watch a golf ball and it's sitting there and all of a sudden somebody goes whack and out it goes, that's the rate that it looked like from our perspective. And then it went to a faint light, and then it was gone. I talked to the controllers the next night, and I asked them, if there was military activity, and it was secret military activity, would the air traffic controller not tell me, because it's a secret? And he said, well, he would probably tell you that there is traffic out there, that he's working, it's military, and that's all he would tell you. But if he does tell you no, there is no traffic, that he's working, and he sees nobody up on his high sector, then he's telling you straight. The only other thing that was unusual, well, not really unusual, that you have to consider, his radar only went out about another 50 miles, was their coverage. And then we were in another sector, and by that time, this thing was long gone. So he didn't see anything farther than 50 miles out on his radar screen, and nothing above us. And they go, I don't know how high they go, 60, 80,000 feet is what they'll go. So he never saw it. And, you know, I've seen the space station fly over Springfield that came over a year or two ago. I've seen shooting stars all the time, seen comets. My buddy John and I over there, we got to see a space shuttle launch during the day, and that's a high rate of speed object too. Doesn't compare to the rate that this departed. There's no comparison. And when I got back home that night, I checked on the computer for UFO sightings that night, and there were two others that same night within an hour of when we saw ours, an hour or two, on the East Coast. And those people said they saw a bright white object moving from their left to their right. We saw it moving from basically our right to our left and then depart.
Which would be the same orientation, just from different perspectives.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, I've been flying for 20 years, and I can honestly say I've never seen anything that I couldn't explain. Somebody could explain this. I'm really glad the Brickyard flight was there. I had him switch. I thought, what am I doing?
Were you ready to jump ship?
I was ready. I was packing my chute. And I told him, you can't hear it on the recording, but it's on there. Rich edited, but I asked him to switch to another frequency so I could talk to them, that flight crew. I said, have you ever seen anything like this in your life? And they said they'd never seen anything move that direction that fast and depart that fast. And I said, man, I'm glad you guys are up here to see it. And he said, well, I'm glad you're up here to see it because this is very unusual.
And Nadine, your wife, saw it.
Yes.
And so there were actually four witnesses.
Yes.
You and Nadine and the pilot and first officer and the Republic Airlines flight.
That's correct. That we were all at the same time looking at the same thing. Mm-hmm. Same color, same direction.
Velocity.
Everything was the same. It was very consistent. It never went up or down that I could tell. It was all lateral. And it certainly looked like either something was controlling it. It wasn't a shooting star, in other words, that was just in an arc and burning out and leaving a tail. It never left a tail, and there was no trail to it. It was just a bright white light, stayed the same intensity until it departed. And then you're just trying to watch the light, and it finally diminished to nothing. So it headed toward the northeast, toward Chicago or something.
Was it headed toward Minneapolis or Chicago?
It's really hard to say. It was a northeast direction.
Okay. Reminds me of Hubert Humphrey. When he was vice president, he visited Moscow. He had a brief meeting with Nikita Khrushchev, the premier. It was supposed to last 5 minutes, lasted 4 hours. And they had a state dinner that Humphrey came to. Khrushchev said, he brought out a map of the United States. He said, where's your city? And Humphrey put an X on Minneapolis. Khrushchev said, when the bombs start falling, they won't fall here. And Humphrey said, I'm afraid I can't make the same assurance with respect to your hometown. But anyway, I don't know what made me think of that. Little color. Would it be correct to say then, Aaron, that you've had thousands of hours of flight time?
Yes.
And this is the only thing you couldn't explain?
Yes. This would be, this was so unusual. And, luckily my wife is there to see it, too. It was so unusual because I remember when I looked up and saw basically what you see there, I thought, I don't remember that being there. What in the world is that? Especially with the full moon, it was very bright. The moon was pretty bright. And it was bright enough, leaving a glare, that you couldn't see any stars out because of the glare of the moon. And you couldn't see any city lights because there's an overcast layer below us. So it's like, well, it's just the moon and that. And that, in perspective to the moon, was brighter, I would say. It was more white and brighter.
Was Venus visible that night?
Yeah, it would have been behind us, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't visible.
It could have been.
Could have been.
I mean, I don't know, but I would have thought, I don't remember Venus moving.
I just was going to say, in terms of brightness, how would you compare it to Venus?
Well,
you've seen Venus a thousand times. How is this, in terms of brightness, compared to a Venus at greatest eastern elongation?
Well, it's crazy. The next night, this really bugged me. This bugged me for a while. It really did, because I'm thinking, there's got to be an explanation for this. And
that's when you came to me.
Yeah, I exhausted everything else, and I came right to you. But I am... Venus, I don't know that much about Venus, and I know that it's out there in the west, and it's very bright. And I remember the next night I went out, and I saw it, and I called my wife, and said, look at that, that looks just like what we saw the other night. And it's like, well, that's not moving. And we're thinking, is it? That's not moving. But it was shimmering, but it wasn't moving. But it was that bright. So if you look at Venus when it's really, really bright, I would say it looked pretty much like that. I got a buddy that works for Boeing, and he goes to White Sands Missile Test Range and does a lot of top-secret stuff. And I'm always trying to get info from him, but he doesn't budge. And I asked him, I said, Ray, this is what I saw. Do we have anything in our military that can do that? And he said, well, not that I know of. Even if we did, I couldn't tell you.
Well, he was a lot of help.
Exactly. He was no help. But he did say he didn't know of anything right now that we have that could do that. So I left the hangar that night. I was really kind of, it bugged me the whole night. But the one thing, being a Christian, I thought, I don't know what that was, and it bugged me, but I was praying on the way out of the hangar, and I said, God, thanks for the safe ride, because they were calling for severe turbulence around the Denver area. And when a 757 reported severe turbulence, we're just a little tiny job. I really perk up when I hear that, because I think, oh, okay, we're little. And we had a nice ride. And I said, God, I hope someday I know what that is. And I just felt him say, whatever that was you saw, I'm bigger. And I thought, good enough. I may only know that. So that's it.
Well, before I went to law school, I had a three-word answer for every question. I don't know. And then after law school, after all those years of study, I still have a three-word answer. It all depends. And so we're going to focus on that now. What was it? Okay, so I've got a few slides here we're going to share. In terms of the public interest in UFOs, I'll just make a few preliminary comments. It's interesting that it really kind of spiked in October of 1947 when a private businessman in Seattle by the name of Kenneth Arnold saw what he described as a half-moon saucer-type object over Mount Rainier in Washington. This is the Horton 229 flying wing aircraft produced by the Horton brothers, Walter and Reinhardt, for the Nazis in the 1930s and into the 1940s. It became operational just in the closing days of World War II. This plane was decades, maybe generations ahead of its day in terms of the sophistication of it. Unfortunately for the Germans, it was too little too late. You know, as they say, the reason that we won World War II is because our German scientists were better than their German scientists. But anyway, that's right. Northrop began using this design to build the flying wing aircraft back in the 50s. And in fact, there were prototypes in the 40s. It really became the forerunner to today's B-2 bomber, the flying wing configuration. And that's a drawing that Arnold made of what he observed in October of 1947. And look how similar that looks to what we've been looking at here. Was he seeing the military flying that plane, trying to understand it better? It's kind of an interesting speculation. But in any event, following Arnold's discovery, there were countless reports of UFOs in the late 40s into the mid-50s and on. And this was a report from shortly after Arnold's. These are images taken in the late 40s into the 50s as the UFO craze went into full gear. And here are what are considered to be the best UFO pictures of 2009. This is looks like a contrail almost right here in the clouds.
Were taken in 2009?
Yes. Wichita, Kansas, 2009.
Oh, that looks like the space shuttle on top of the...
Yeah,
it looks like what?
The space shuttle riding the 747.
Yeah. It does look like the space shuttle riding the 747.
I think that's what it is.
Okay. Well, we just answered that problem. Okay. Cross that off the list. That's good. This is an expert panel. What are you laughing at out there? We've come to provide answers. California, January 10th of 2009. That thing dangling from that antenna. I can tell you that's a fake. And this kid's kite. Here's what you come for, the bottom line. You wanted to hear that ATC recording, and we did that. Now, how can we explain these sightings? That's what we're going to address now. Well, the first, and these are not in any order. I'm just going to throw these out, and our panel can weigh in. The first explanation, and by the way, we're going to look at five or six possible explanations, and my view is that probably a number of these are accurate. I don't think there's maybe one and only one explanation to these sightings. But certainly one that I think covers some substantial number is the fact of a hoax. And I mentioned here the Adlerian search for significance principle. Some of you are familiar with Alfred Adler, a Viennese psychologist contemporary of Sigmund Freud, moved to the United States. He was Jewish after the Nazis took over in Germany. He dies in 1937, born 1870. But one of the many things for which he's famous is the search for significance. And his basic idea was this, that every one of us is born with a profound sense of inferiority. And we spend our entire lives seeking to compensate for that by achieving some level of significance. And for the vast majority of people, they can't do it. Maybe hitting a home run in a softball game, writing a book. I mean, what impels people to seek to be productive, to go on for advanced education, to get an A on a test? It is this Adlerian craving for significance and notoriety that drives us. For the vast majority of people, there's nothing they can do. Adler says this principle asserts itself in the home with sibling rivalry as young children seek to vie for their parents' attention. But I believe this principle is a powerful concept, and I think it does explain some of these hoaxes. And the point is this. And here you are, an obscure person, maybe never accomplished anything noteworthy in your life. And to say, I saw a UFO, can catapult you to celebrity status, especially if you were abducted. So we see in recent, last year, October 15th, 2009, we had that horrific story of that father in Fort Collins, Colorado, that built a UFO, kind of a flying saucer-shaped balloon, and it lifted up. And he said, my 6 or 7 year old son is on board. The balloon boy, Falcon Heen. And here's his flying saucer balloon right here. That thing flew up to more than 7,000 feet. It flew over 50 miles. It grabbed the attention of the international media. People were following it. He was approaching the Denver airport. They shut down Stapleton Airport in Denver because of this. The thing finally comes down to earth about 10 miles from Stapleton Airport. The boy was not on it. That triggered a manhunt to find him. He must have fallen off somewhere along the way. Well, it turned out he was hiding under his bed back home. As he said on the Larry King show, we did it for the show. And so it was determined to be a hoax. But that father got his wish, didn't he? Worldwide recognition by making a fraudulent claim. Photoshop, another way to make a hoax. Anybody with Photoshop with a camera and a green screen, you just take a picture of your little metal flying saucer in front of a green screen, and then you substitute a picture of anything you want. And it looks very realistic, doesn't it? It's very easy to do. And then we have natural phenomena as another potential explanation. Project Blue Book. The Air Force describes it as follows. From 1947 to 1969, the Air Force investigated unidentified flying objects under Project Blue Book. The project, headquartered at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio, was terminated in 1969. Of a total of 12,600 sightings reported to Project Blue Book, 700 remained unidentified, approximately 5%. The main results of that statistical analysis were that the vast majority of these sightings probably fell in within one of these naturalistic explanations. Let me run through some of these. Look at some of the experimental spacecraft. Could somebody think that's a UFO? Meteors and bolides. Have you ever seen a bolide? A detonating fireball?
I've seen that picture.
That literally explodes. It's like you could say maybe it's a large meteor. But it leaves a trail. I've never seen one directly, but one happened behind me when I was out observing in my driveway one night, and it cast my shadow on the entire driveway. The thing was so bright.
It was not like a shape. It was like that. I don't know what you really saw. You kept saying white light.
Round.
The round?
Yeah.
No trail.
No trail.
No trail, just round.
Just light. Round. Almost to that scale. If that was the moon, if the moon was, you know, like a... It was almost to that scale, but round. Just like
all?
A white light, just round.
That's all?
No glow, no flashing anything, just a white, bright light.
No shape of the airship or nothing, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
That's all?
It's just white light, like watching a flashlight.
But you did get the sense that you were resolving the shape, not that it was just so bright that you saw, a blob that was, it could have been anywhere in there. Like when you're looking at a comet, you know, you see this, you might see a big head, but the real thing is in deep inside there. But did you have a clear enough sense that you were actually resolving seeing the edge of the object?
No.
Okay.
It was like
no detail in the object.
A box, for all I know, with a real bright light in front of it, and the light was so bright you couldn't see anything else around it, any shape. You know, okay. it's just a bright white light.
Well, let's go on and look at some other theories. Comets, of course. Some have thought that they were UFOs. Space junk. Dr. Greg is one of the foremost experts, probably in the world, on the study of space debris. We have millions of objects, man-made, in space orbit right now, varying sizes, that presents a significant risk to spacecraft. And some of that falls back to the Earth, a lot of it, if not most of it. Here's an example of a part of a rocket that landed in Saudi Arabia a few years ago. But as these things enter the atmosphere...
They burn up if they're smaller than a certain size of, many centimeters across or close to a meter. They'll completely burn up. Really big things make it to the ground.
Yeah, but they still are illuminated.
Well, yeah, of course, there's intense friction, and so they're glowing white hot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's the International Space Station, and then the what's called the Iridium Constellation, which is a group of about 66 satellites with highly reflective aluminum antennae that exist for global communications purposes, such as phone technology. These things, if you're looking at the right spot in the sky, you can actually see a flash of the sun reflecting off these highly reflective antennae. In fact, my planetarium software that I use to control my telescope alerts me to iridium flashes, where they're predicted in the sky to occur and at what times. Parhelia, or sun dogs, comes from two Greek words, par, meaning next to or beside, and helia, the sun. This is a result of the refraction of sunlight going through ice crystals that can form a circular halo around the sun, or depending on the orientation of those crystals, these sun dogs that are about 22 degrees on either side of the sun can be identified as UFOs. Here we see moon dogs, the same phenomenon with the moon. Lenticular clouds, these are large masses of moist air going over mountains. Many times these are misidentified as UFOs. And sprites, which it's kind of a cold plasma type of electric discharge, similar to lightning, I suppose. But they're up above thunderstorms, and they can be multicolored and sometimes misidentified. Japanese squid boats, which shine very bright lights on the water to bring squid to the surface. And on the horizon, as you see right here, those can be misidentified as UFOs. Now, let's talk about the third possible explanation. Greg, I'm going to turn it over to you. And that's the extraterrestrial hypothesis that UFOs, in fact, have an extraterrestrial origin.
Yeah. One thing you didn't mention is ball lightning, which I find an interesting possibility, although I've never heard of ball lightning moving like you said. But my mother, when she was little, there was an open window, and... two open windows in the house, and it was stormy outside, and she remembers seeing ball lightning coming in through the window, floating across over her younger sister's crib and out the window. Ball lightning is controversial. Some people don't believe it exists, but I've talked to several people who have seen that, and that has a spherical type of shape, typically, but doesn't usually last very long, and I don't think it would make the motion that you said. But it can make erratic motion.
Where
so.
Do you get that elevation? I
doubt that. I think that would it's always low, as far as I know, always quite low down. But yeah.
Speaking of that, I've heard people talk about lightning, or maybe it's a static field up in airplanes that has entered an airplane, and I've heard people say they've seen it go down the aisle of the plane and go out. So I don't know if that's the same thing, but I've heard of that.
Yeah. Well, I just talked to someone called me about, I think it was about a year ago, and he said that twice in his house, somewhere in a small town near Springfield, just before a storm, a sphere materialized in his room and then disappeared with a loud bang, And he was frightened. And, you know, it happened twice in a row. And he said, what's up with that? I said, I don't know. People, I've heard stories about ball lightning. I've heard it said, although I wouldn't want to claim this is true, but that if we could understand how electromagnetic radiation could be confined in a spherical, you know, floating orb like that, perhaps we could solve the problem of nuclear fusion, and, you know, we would solve our energy problems, because we don't know how ball lightning works. Although often when it explodes, there's a sulfurous smell afterwards. I was just reading about that before here because I was thinking I should look up that ball lightning again. But I don't know. I don't know what to say about that.
I had you as a professional astronomer. Mm-hmm. I think everybody would be interested. Have you ever seen a UFO?
No. I remember as a little kid, I had a telescope, much like Richard has, but a much smaller. But I was out every night as a kid looking at the stars. And I think I remember seeing a little thing moving across the sky, and then it stopped and moved back. But I have to say, you know, one of the issues that is difficult in this whole problem is that human recollection is often erroneous. I mean, we think we remember things. I've discovered there's some things that I was absolutely sure I remembered that didn't actually happen, because, you know, I just found proof that, hey, I thought I remembered that. So it's nice that you had two different, you know, four people in two different aircraft seeing this, because that would have made me feel better too. I was interested. A couple of thoughts I had was, one was when this thing was straight between you and the moon, there would be forward scattering off of an object there, and that's like when we want to say look at particles, like say the rings of Saturn. The best place to do it is when the light from the sun is on the opposite side of the planet, because small particles forward scatter. And so, in fact, we didn't even know Jupiter had a ring until the Voyager spacecraft flew by and looked back from a vantage point that had never seen before. It looked at Jupiter from the opposite side of the sun, and then there was a ring. And you see the same thing when dust is in a room. You know, sunlight is coming into a room, a sunbeam. If you look almost in the direction of the sunlight, then you'll see the dust. But if you're off to the side, you don't see it. So that, I was thinking about that forward scattering, if that could possibly be an issue, although that usually is for very small particles. So I don't think that makes sense. And you said that the brightness of the object didn't change significantly as it went from, how far was it to the right of the moon if the moon was 12 o'clock? Okay.
And it never went to the right side of the moon.
Okay.
It never went past our 12 o'clock, I would say.
Yeah.
It stayed more to our 11:30-ish.
Okay.
And then moved left.
Yeah. This is very interesting. Another thought that came to my mind, across my mind as we were talking about this, trying to think of a natural explanation, is what astronomers know as retrograde motion. How the planets, the ancient astronomers, ancient Greeks and thousands of years ago noticed that the planets, planet means wanderer, planets would move eastward across the sky, and then they'd turn around and move westward for a little while, and then they'd turn again and move eastward, and so they called them wanderers because of the way they moved across the sky, but over a course of months, you know, or weeks to months. But I've actually observed this same phenomenon on the freeway. Because, you know, I think about these kind of things all the time. If you're on a freeway and you're banking toward the left and you're in the fast lane, you're just like a planet going around the sun. And if there are cars that are slower in the right lane, if you watch them against the trees behind, you will see them appear to move in one direction. And then as you pass them, they'll appear to move the other direction. And then they'll turn around and go back the same direction relative to the trees and, you know, distant objects behind them. So I was wondering if you had any change. Was there any banking going on, or any change in orientation or direction? You were in straight and level flight at that point, right? So that doesn't make sense. But that phenomenon of retrograde motion seemed like a conceivably, yeah. But I think that could probably be ruled out. Yeah, and I asked you about the changes in brightness. Very interesting. So as far as extraterrestrial hypothesis. That's a really huge question mark with many, many factors that are unknown. And there's a very famous equation called the Drake equation. How many of you know about that? Yeah, okay, great. It's basically a series of probabilities. You start with, if we want to talk about, let's say we want to know if there's intelligent extraterrestrial life in our galaxy, that could potentially be visiting us, or simply just living out, you know, far away and not visiting. But you start with the number of planets in the galaxy, or sorry, the number of stars in the galaxy, which is over 200 billion. And then you take that number and you multiply by the fraction of those that have planets. We now know that that fraction is probably close to 50%. When I was a kid, we didn't know that. So we probably have, 100 billion stars with planets. So now you have those, that number of planets. Then you, stars with planets. Then you multiply that number by the typical number of planets that are in the correct distance from the sun, from the star, per star, Earth-like planets, let's say, for example. And then that gives you another number. You keep multiplying by these factors. The next factor is the probability that now that you've got Earth-like planets, you have some estimate of the number of Earth-like planets that can potentially have life. Now you multiply that number by the unknown factor of how often does life develop on a planet where the conditions are favorable for life. And this is a very interesting, huge, open question. And some say it's unanswerable currently. Some scientists believe that since life exists here on Earth, it must exist wherever the conditions are right. It must develop. So then, what fraction of those go on to develop into life forms that are intelligent, and then what fraction of those develop technology, and then you multiply by the average lifetime of a technological civilization before they blow themselves up, and so there's all these factors, and they're all unknowns. So you could end up with millions. Well, I shouldn't say they're all unknowns, but we know some of them, some of these factors better now than ever. You can end up with a million intelligent races in our galaxy, or we might be the only one. It's a giant unknown. One interesting aspect is interesting. A few years ago, how many of you remember the discovery of life in a meteorite from Mars? A supposed discovery of fossil life in a meteorite from Mars. So that was very interesting. It was back in 1996 when that claim was first made. I thought, if this is true, everyone should be walking around with their jaws hanging open. Life discovered in a meteorite that we know came from the planet Mars. We know from its isotopic composition that it came from the planet Mars. And we now have, like, probably by now, perhaps three dozen meteorites that literally are pieces of Mars that were launched into space by asteroid collisions and then floated around in space and eventually landed on the Earth. We have like three dozen of these, undoubtedly pieces of the planet Mars. And this one, apparently, it's very controversial, but some very credible scientists believe there's strong evidence for fossil life in this thing. So here's an interesting point, is that if the Earth has life on it and Mars has life or had life, then you have two planets in the same solar system with life. And if life is unlikely, that would be like two people in your family both winning the lottery. You know, how likely is it that anyone wins the lottery? But then imagine you win the lottery, you get $100 million, and then your brother scrapes off the thing and he wins $100 million. The chances of two in one family is unbelievably small, unless it's quite likely that it's quite common to win the lottery, which we know it isn't. But if there is life discovered on Mars, that says an interesting thing about life farther out. Interestingly, when I talk about life developing on planets, a lot of people say, okay, you're talking like, it's not God. But there are many people, myself included, that believe, God creates in ways that beyond our simple minds can possibly imagine, and we have to accept what science indicates to us if we find that it's credible. So, God could create through, who wrote the laws of physics? But at any rate, so life elsewhere, my personal belief is I just don't know. There could be a huge number of intelligent extraterrestrial civilizations, or we might be the only one. Either way, it's amazing, isn't it? Because, if we're the only one, wow, But if there's millions of them, wow, that's amazing too. Either way, it certainly makes me appreciate life in both respects. But so life, there's a lot that could be said, and I probably shouldn't go. When should I shut up? Because life based on carbon, could we base it on other molecules or other elements? You hear controversy about that. Could there be silicon-based life? Could there be life based on other elements that are in the same column of the periodic table as carbon? And most chemists that I know, molecular biologists, would say no, because the complexity that carbon is able to have and display, it far outweighs even silicon. Silicon makes spectacular minerals
and computer chips,
yeah. So there are a huge number of unknowns. Another question, interesting point is, if there are intelligent beings on other planets, then it's a whole additional question, how could they possibly get to us? Because if the distances to the stars are so spectacularly huge that I know I can't even comprehend them. If our sun was the size of a golf ball, the nearest star, the Proxima Centauri system, would be like another golf ball in the city of New York. You know, I mean, just spectacular distances. The time it would take to get there, say traveling at 7 miles per second like the Apollo astronauts, would be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. So these beings would have to travel much faster than we're able to travel. And then we have a fundamental limit, which is the speed of light. And the closer you get to the speed of light, the harder it is to accelerate, because your energy becomes like mass. And it's, the faster you go, the more you're carrying your own kinetic energy, like inertia, and it's harder to go faster, and to such a degree that the physics tells us, physics as we know it, that it's impossible to reach the speed of light, and it gets more and more impossible, more and more improbable the closer you get. So, but if you do get close to the speed of light, you have some advantages, because distances shrink in the direction you're traveling, which is an advantage. If you're going to Kansas City, imagine as you approach the speed limit of 50 miles an hour, the distance to Kansas City shrinks to 3 feet. You don't have as far to go anymore. It doesn't make any sense, but it's true. That happens. It's called contraction. And then there's time distortion. So it could go on and on. But what I am saying is that if there is intelligent life elsewhere, the technological problems of reaching other star systems seem to be insurmountable. Where would the energy come from it to travel these distances? Maybe they live enormous lengths of time. Or maybe they go so close to the speed of light that they are able to, their time becomes distorted. In that case, when they leave their home planet, they would have to say goodbye to everyone they're ever going to know, because when they come back after what may seem like a few years' journey to some other star system, thousands of years may have passed back on their home planet. So maybe they bring all their loved ones with them, you know. And there's also the hypothesis that the Earth is like a hands-off zoo, you know. Don't touch. We're watching. You know, it's like the prime directive of Star Trek, which... It sounds kind of crazy, perhaps. I mean, these are not, mainstream scientists don't go around talking about this a whole lot. It does kind of get you close to what we call academic suicide to have this interest. I mean, I think it's a fascinating question, but I'm not interested enough to make that my passion as a scientist. And if I did, if that was my mission, I'd do it, but it's not. So, you know, there are a lot of big questions, and there's a huge amount of fraud. In sightings of things, and you know, people love to make stuff up. My wife's friend, who videoed our wedding, he actually made a set of feet, a giant feet that he could put his feet in. He attached them to his boots, and he was living in Seattle, and then he went up on Snoqualmie Pass and walked around, you know, and then he came back down and waited. And sure enough, there's a newspaper article about it, you know. These strange tracks seen. So people like to do that. That wasn't the case here. I mean, how could you fake that? So, yeah. So anyway, I think hoaxes are the best protection that the true thing, if the real thing exists, the best protection against us finding out about it is the fact that there's so many hoaxes that also exist, and that kind of clouds the whole issue. Anyway, could go on. life could exist on our in our own solar system in the clouds of Jupiter, but I think I'll leave that for some other time, or beneath the surface of Mars. There's tantalizing evidence that methane seeps out of the surface of Mars, and it's found with water vapor around in the equatorial regions. And what does that mean? Methane on Earth is biogenic. It comes from living things. So why is there methane seeping out of the inside of Mars? You know, I want to go dig, you know, in Mars. I dream about once a month, I dream of walking on Mars, and I discover a fossil or something, and I hyperventilate and pass out. Anyway, I'll give it back to Richard.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much, Dr. Gregg. Yes. Awesome. Speaking about travel time, I just composed this chart a few years ago on gamma time based on the relativistic time dilation based on velocity. And as Gregg said, look at the speeds that you must achieve to have any significant gamma time. This is the differential between what you think time is traveling and a stationary frame of reference. And so even if you're up here, Gregg, this is amazing, at 90% C, the gamma is only 2.3. It's noticeable, but hardly. And you only get significant gamma times when you get down here to 99 point followed by nine nines after the decimal. You're looking at inches short of 186,000 miles per second. Not quite there, but almost there. And then look at your gamma, 22,000. You literally can make it to the Andromeda Galaxy in 134 years, potentially. So Carl Sagan used that example. The key is getting up to that speed, and as you say, how can you? Because the faster you go, the more energy that you need, and that requires more weight and makes it more difficult to accelerate. So that's the paradox, but the calculus that applies.
Could they not travel, not physically? We're thinking about a physical thing. Could they travel, like, vicariously, some way where they leave their planet, but they're not physically coming there? But they then all of a sudden appear on Earth.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that in just a minute. Greg's an expert on that. But look at anybody in motion has a different time than somebody that's stationary. So just driving down Glenstone, you're aging more slowly than somebody sitting here. But it is so small, it's kind of like the Doppler effect 150 years ago. Christian Doppler speculated that sound would vary in pitch based on velocity of a and it was all he had was a horse with a guy with a bugle, and they couldn't hear it. It wasn't until the invention of locomotives that Doppler was proven to be correct. Similarly here, there is a differential. Even an F-16 pilot, look at you get down here to the Earth's escape velocity, the space shuttle, you know, you have a slight gamma there, but not actually discernible. Yeah, so these are some of the problems with the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Is it feasible, as Dr. Gregg pointed out, the immense distances, the cost, the speed of light problem? Another one that's kind of interesting to me is food. I mean, if you're going from Earth to the Proxima Centauri system, 4.2 light years away, and that trip, depending on your speed, may take tens of thousands of years, how do you, and there's no planets in between, how do you feed the crew? I mean, you're going to get tired of Tang and granola bars. And then another one is the social pathologies. Just like I tell my astronomy students at Evangel, how would you like to be in a closet with two other people for 2 years traveling to Mars? Or maybe in a garage traveling farther with maybe 50 people. The social pathologies, could you avoid killing one another? That's absolutely right. There is a psychology to space travel that's got to be determined. In fact, many people say that one of the reasons that we cannot believe in extraterrestrial intelligence is that when you achieve a certain level of intelligence, your ability to destroy yourselves through technology exceeds your moral restraint, and you're going to self-destruct. Just imagine Al-Qaeda getting nuclear weapons. So the point is, one study showed that a trip to the nearest star beyond our solar system at 70% the speed of light would require 500,000 years of the total U.S. energy consumption. And so the question is, why would anyone, anywhere, want to incur such cost? What is the motivation, and is it technologically feasible? And then you mentioned the Fermi paradox. If intelligent civilizations exist, They will colonize, just like the Americas. Within 20 or 30 years of the discovery of the Americas by Europeans, the whole eastern and western seaboards were filled with settlements. Humans colonize. Intelligent life spreads out and colonizes. The same would be true in a galaxy. Fermi estimated one star system colonized every 1,000 years would lead to complete colonization of the entire galaxy in only 25 million years. They should be dominating our galaxy. They should be everywhere. And his question, his rhetorical question was, where are they? Now, other potential explanations, the interdimensional hypothesis that UFOs may be evidence of another dimension that we're intersecting with.
I'll turn it over to Greg.
Well, for the interdimensional hypothesis? Okay. Well, of course, string theory proposes that there are currently believed either 10 or 11 dimensions, including time. But the according to string theorists, the other dimensions beside the three and time that we see that we can perceive are hard to perceive because, as they say, they're curled up very tightly. So I don't think that helps. But how many dimensions are there? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Currently, there is the discussion, the common term of the multiverse that has come into popular discussion in astronomy, that there may be numerous universes, and perhaps they collide in a sort of a hyper universe called the multi-universe, and that may have initiated the Big Bang. It's very speculative. Multiple universes. How far apart would they have to be separated? I mean, perhaps there is a way to transfer from one universe to another. Does anybody like to watch Fringe? The show Fringe? It's a great, great science fiction show. There's another Earth and everybody's there. It's almost identical to the present Earth. This is fiction. I don't know. Traveling between dimensions is what we're talking about. Some potentially other worlds that are maybe not as far away as we think, but simply separated in a direction that we can't possibly visualize because we're confined to a three-dimensional space manifold. You know, imagine paper doll people being able to imagine the third dimension. They can't. Yet, you know, there could be motion. Something could come from a third dimension. I don't think there's any scientific basis for any of that at this point, but there is a lot we don't know, so I'll give that back to you.
Yeah, some theorists I've read indicate that Einstein apparently inferred this, that there can be no exchange of information between dimensions, other than perhaps gravity, that maybe that accounts for rotational light curves in galaxies, spiral galaxies, you know, the dark matter. That there's a gravitational force acting on spiral galaxies that would indicate that the mass of these galaxies is maybe five times greater than what we actually perceive. One argument is that they are being influenced by gravity from another dimensional source that we can only examine or identify because of gravitational interaction. No other information can be exchanged between dimensions. So that's kind of an interesting. And, in fact, there were experiments done just in the last few years with highly precise gravitational measuring devices. I know Emory University did this. There was in Colorado they did this, measuring to see if Newton's gravitational constant is, or his law of universal gravitation, is accurate to a very precise level. Or are there variations in it because we may be interacting with another dimension? And they determined there's no interaction with another dimension in Atlanta or in Colorado. So there you go. Interesting to speculate.
Yeah, the graviton is, as string theorists say, that there's evidence that the graviton, according to existing theories, which are very tentative at this point, but the graviton may not be confined to our universe. And may this is what you're saying, may actually be able to move from one universe to another, or from one we call a manifold or a membrane, a brain is what they call it. And so our whole universe could be the surface of it could be a membrane of three or four dimensions that's floating in some higher dimensional or space. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
And in a multiverse where there's an infinite number of possibilities, of course, anything's possible. You're hitting a home run now for the St. Louis Cardinals in one universe. You know, you're a famous author in another. I mean, everything is possible if there's an infinite – all things are possible in an infinite number of universes, which in my opinion is just a cop-out by minds that reject the potential of a creator God. Because once you take that option off the table, what are you left with? The spontaneous generation of matter, energy, space, and time, and ultimately of intelligence itself. I think there's another option that historically, throughout the history of the last 2,000 years, the best scientists agreed that there is a creator, and that explains it. It's only been in the last few generations that that has changed, and I think it's a temporary anomaly. And then we have the psychosocial hypothesis. What people report as UFO experiences are the result of psychological misperception mechanisms strongly influenced by popular culture. And then the sixth and final option or explanation that I'll mention, I'm kind of inclined toward this myself. And again, I want to emphasize, I don't think any one of these is the answer to all these sightings. I think there's probably many of these that have to be taken into account. Certainly natural explanations, hoaxes are very important. But I also think there's a spiritual dimension, and a lot of people believe this, and let me explain what I mean. Most of the UFO sightings, I would say a preponderance of them, are a non-physical phenomenon. There's no physical evidence. They don't show up on radar. They don't leave hubcaps. And there's no close-up, authentic photos or videos. You've got the hurdles to interstellar travel that we've talked about. You've got violation of the laws of physics, of objects doing zigzags, the Republic pilot saying 180-degree turn, stopping and coming back at a high velocity. It's impossible physically. It violates the laws of physics to make movements like that. So a non-physical phenomenon. The spiritual hypothesis would say, yes, Scripture has many examples of non-physical but real phenomena. For example, the angelic realm, spiritual, non-corporeal, no, comes from the Latin corpus or body. There's no body to angelic beings. They're not limited by the laws of physics. They have interactions with humans we see repeatedly throughout Scripture. Could that be a potential explanation for what we're seeing in some of these UFO sightings? In my opinion, I think that's a, if you don't take doubt off the table, I think that's got to be on the table. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our explanations. And, Dale, do we have any extra time? Okay, so I thought we could just take just audience questions at this point, guys. What do you think? You up to that? Audience questions. Yes.
When you're talking about traveling at light speed, you were saying, I don't think I quite understand. You were saying basically you get heavier as the faster you go, you get heavier.
Right.
To continue accelerating because you're getting heavier, but yet the distance between point A and point B gets shorter.
Right. It's basically, you can say, you know, we know that everyone learns E equals MC squared. It's a real easy equation to at least talk about in grade school and so on. Mass and energy are equivalent. So when you approach the speed of light, your energy becomes so huge that it has an associated, it's like mass energy, we often call it, and it has an inertia. And so the closer you get to the speed of light, the heavier you get. And people often talk about traveling at light speed. And I always, in physics classes, I always try to say, wait a minute. You know, you can't say at light speed. You know, people often ask the question, if you're traveling at the speed of light and you turn your headlights on, does anything happen? You know, but you can't travel at the speed of light. According to physics as we know it, you can't travel at the speed of light unless you have no mass, unless you are pure energy, like a photon. And photons are everywhere at once, which is another weird
frame of reference. In the dark energy, you can actually be exceeding the speed of light at distant galaxies because of the stretching of the universe.
Right, yeah. The universe is expanding, and so there can be what appears to be faster than light travel when, in fact, the fabric of space is expanding like a loaf of raisin bread dough in all directions, and there may be things that appear to be receding from you at faster than the speed of light, but it's actually because the very fabric of space itself is expanding.
Galaxies are going to blend out in the distant future, and the visible universe is going to become less.
the universe is expanding. So so things the standard story is that things get farther and farther apart. There will eventually be heat death. We thought there would be a big crunch, a turning around of the whole thing and a collapse. Right now it seems that our universe is teetering on the edge for an unbelievably fine razor edge between infinite expansion and collapse. And that's almost certainly not a coincidence. Another thing that Richard mentioned that I thought I was going to say talk about is that these accelerations that you hear about, these UFOs exhibit, as Aaron mentioned, if you were a human being in a spacecraft that made a sudden erratic motion like that, you'd be splattered, you know, on the wall of the thing. So what is, if there were extraterrestrials in there, what are they made out of, you know? Maybe it's a robotic, you know, something, but the G-forces would be unbelievable given the types of erratic motions that we see. Let me say one other thing while I'm at it. I've mentioned this. I talked to my friends at NASA about everything, and I mentioned this to them, and they're all open-minded, but they say one thing that comes up in descriptions of UFOs is that humans often misperceive a change in direction of an object because they look away, or I don't know, for various reasons, they're certain that it changed direction when it didn't. That was one thing I came here to kind of be curious about. Is there any possible way that you could imagine, Aaron, that this thing didn't actually change its direction? I mean, is that, if I had seen it, and as I've understood what you've said, I would say, yeah, okay, maybe that can happen, but this thing changed direction. Is that what you would say?
Well, yes. It when I first saw it, it looked like pretty much what you see there, the straight line across the horizon line. And it's like, well, where did that come from? I mean, that wasn't there a minute ago or a few seconds ago. And it's like, well, all right, but it doesn't look like it's moving. So if it's coming right at me, I was thinking, we got someone that's going to pass overhead.
Yeah.
That's why I inquired. I thought, this is odd. But then it started the lateral, and then it accelerated, and then it stopped, and then it moved the other way, backwards.
Lateral motion.
Oh, absolutely. You heard the Brickyard crew say, he's covering a lot of ground very fast.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, well, we're just seeing it in a constant, trajectory,
right?
Because it was level, I would say. It didn't pitch up or down, but it definitely moved, stopped, either backed up or made a big U-turn, still keeping the light. And then when it went out,
yeah.
I don't think there would be any way, and my wife would tell you the same thing, it would be impossible to say we didn't see this thing in motion.
In changing motion. Not just motion,
but
motion that is
correct.
Changing.
Reversing direction and then departing. It would be impossible to say we didn't see that.
Yeah. Of course, that first motion you mentioned from roughly almost 12 o'clock to, say, 10:30 or something, if the thing was, you were getting a lot closer to it and it still didn't look any different, it was, so bright, you would see that thing seem to go back to 10:20 or something. Your
right.
distance is shrinking. You see it move like that. But then
right.
to turn around and take off.
Right.
Yeah.
It certainly looked like we were going to just watch an airplane go overhead.
Yeah.
From all of my experience,
right.
I thought, well, this guy left his landing lights on.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's up high. This is a military flight. He's going to mm-hmm. come over the top. And this is interesting because nobody's really above that altitude.
Right.
I mean, I hardly ever hear anything above 45.
Yeah.
And
have you ever seen anything above 45?
No. I've heard of there's a Gulfstream aircraft, and I think one time I heard one checking in at 47, and I think their service ceiling is 51.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to a Gulfstream pilot one time. He said the only time they do that is if they're coming across the Atlantic and fuel's a consideration. But when you get up that high, you're basically standing on a bowling ball because you're right at the envelope of what that airplane's capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And for this thing to move
that direction at that rate of speed, like I said, it would have to seem like he was very close to us for us to get that perception of speed.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's more incredible is he couldn't see it more than 60 miles or 50 miles out on his radar. And 50 miles is a pretty long, it's a pretty good distance.
Mm-hmm.
If I see an airliner or a military plane at 50 miles, which would I can't see. Even, I mean, maybe at night I might see a landing light, maybe. But you would never see it move that at that rate of speed.
And you wouldn't see a landing light at 50,000 feet, would you?
You would if it was coming at you. But if he made any kind of turns away from your direct line of sight, then it's going to change. It's going to change sheen. It's going to you're mm-hmm. going to lose part of the glow of it. But the farther something mm-hmm. is away, usually you don't sense the speed. Remember the hail buff? You could watch that for a month and it didn't look like it moved.
Right.
But this thing. I mean, this thing was moving very fast.
So what we're really talking about here is angular speed. Speed, you know, in terms of direction as a muthal speed, rather, because you couldn't really perceive its actual speed because you couldn't resolve it. So it could have been way out at the moon going zzz, close to the speed of light. You
could have been.
Possibly.
I have no idea how far away that
right.
was.
Yeah,
so no idea.
Yeah, and then when it took off, it I wanted to imagine that it was taking off and going up, but it stayed level. More or less, as far as you can tell.
It stayed level the whole
mm-hmm.
time.
Yeah.
And then the most impressive is when it departed, because when it departed, if there is a warp speed, I mean, that's probably what he was doing.
Well, there is. Haven't you seen Star Trek?
Well, yeah.
So was that, you say 9:30 p.m.?
It was about 9:20 Central Time.
So it was dark at 45,000?
It was dark, yeah.
Dark,
it was there. The sun had been down, and we watched the sun go down behind us. It was a really nice sunset, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes prior to that.
So did you see other stars?
No, because the moon was so bright and so brilliant, it was just kind of, it was kind of like looking at stars on a big city. You go to New York, try to look at stars. I don't know if they've ever seen them.
So you don't think that all the UFO stories, they have a shape, the picture, everything, but you didn't see the shape because of the darkness?
Correct. It was dark where I wouldn't say I could see that. Even if an airplane with a landing light on or something, you would never see the shape. You would just see
the
light. Just
too far away.
It's just too far and just not enough. But airplanes have lights on their wingtip, a green and a red light, and flashing strobe lights, which this didn't appear to have at all. Just bright light.
In the back.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. I think they're related. They're for Aaron and the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to judge the distance to this object, the size of the object, or the intensity of the light? So, and in relation to that same question, what was your geographic position?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask that.
And what was the geographic position of the other reports that you mentioned that evening and their time proximity to your experience?
Okay. Well, first of all, if the controller said, you have a military aircraft at your 12 o'clock, he's westbound, and he's whatever. And if they said, you got to guess how far away he is, I would say, he's probably 10 to 20 miles tops. Just in my experience of seeing a light, and it's probably 20 miles away. The size of the object, I would say if the moon was, I would say it's that scale. You know, I mean, I really think, and I know that looks lame, but when we looked up, it wasn't there before. And I wish I would have been watching outside to see when it showed up. But it's like, well, you know, it would be like you looking at the screen now and seeing a big bright dot. So when did that get there? So I don't know where it came from, but it wasn't there a few minutes before because the moon wasn't really far above the horizon, so it was quick. Our geographic location was, if you're familiar with Nebraska and Kansas, the border, think about the middle of the border, but a little south into Kansas. We were just... If you were looking at a map of the U.S., we were quarter inch below the border of Nebraska and Kansas, about midway. Was that all of them? Did I get them?
No, in addition, the reports that you had researched.
Oh, that's right.
It was around New Jersey. There was two in New Jersey, and they gave a Greenwich Mean Time, which is what the air traffic control bases everything on. And I looked at that, and it was within a 1.5 to 2 hour period of when we saw ours, and they were looking at it in the western sky, moving from their left to right. And I don't know anything about UFOs. You know, I've never seen anything I really couldn't explain. And I just Googled UFO sightings, United States. I mean, I barely know how to work a computer, to be honest with you. So I just Googled this to see what happened. And then there was two that I saw in New Jersey or New York area within an hour to an hour and a half, 2 hours of ours, a bright white light moving, stopping, accelerating fast from left to right. Brickyard was at our 4 o'clock position behind us, 10,000 feet below us, 40 miles to our right, heading northeastbound. We were heading about 090. He was heading about 060. He was heading to Milwaukee. So when we first saw it, and I was like, well, that's kind of odd, and it sort of seemed to be moving a little right. That's when I thought, well, I don't think this is the space station. I think the space station would be going the other way. At least the last time I saw it go over, it was moving that direction. And that's when he said, yeah, it was coming toward us. So if it was moving to our right slightly, he would have the perspective that it was coming at him since he was behind us to the right. And then it went left and then out. So that was where he was.
I want to ask a question of an audience member here. John Savage, you want to come up here? John is a very experienced pilot, decades of flying Air Force and private, thousands of hours in a cockpit. I mean, how many UFOs have you seen?
Well, while in the Air Force, we used to scramble on them every once in a while. Anybody here who's Air Force type and worked in radar, et cetera, you remember in the 70s, 60s, they used to scramble on them. And what we mean by scramble is the guys on alert shack jumping the fighters take off and go and say, hey, we got something on the radar. And he'd get there and he says, whoop, it's gone. So, anyway.
Did you ever see?
That's my story.
Did you ever scramble on one?
No, I never did. Never did, no.
But you talked to people who did, or?
Yeah.
But in all the years of personal flying as a pilot, did you ever see anything?
No, never did.
Okay.
Aurora Borealis was the only thing one night. We were coming out of Chicago, January night, real cold, and that curtain, Aurora Borealis followed us all the way almost to Columbia, Missouri. Just beautiful, just shimmering and glowing, and that's about the only thing.
Okay.
So,
well, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to overdo this, but did we have a question up here?
No, I was just going to say I mentioned at the last meeting in the winter of 51 at Columbus, Indiana, south of Indianapolis, that we had spotted a bright light stationary west of Columbus, Indiana. Can't remember the height, but it wasn't very high. And in watching this light, all at once it took off and zipped up towards Indianapolis, Indiana. And in the next day's paper, and I called the Indianapolis Center, and they didn't have anything. The next day paper, they had local pilots in the terminal area getting ready to land, spot this sighting. And one said it was off his right wing, it paced his aircraft, and they just took off. Mm-hmm. So if you had that paper back in 51, they'd give you a little report of what was being given.
Very good. Interesting.
Scrambled out a right path on that.
Okay. Dale, do you want to come on back up? We probably ought to adjourn our time, but I hope you found that to be informative and interesting.
Yes.